Welcome. Classical rhetorical manuals instruct that when one is introducing someone, one may draw on a variety of modes. If we speak in praise, says the first century rhetorica ad Arenium, we shall say that we are doing so from a sense of duty, because ties of friendship exist, or from goodwill, because such is the virtue of the person under discussion that everyone should wish to call it to mind. Well, such instructions would not be hard to follow for Elaine Pagels, the Harrington Spear Payne Foundation Professor of Religion at Princeton, and the author of such well-known and groundbreaking books as the Gnostic Gospels, Adam and Eve and the Serpent, and Beyond Belief, the Secret Gospel of Thomas. Professor Pagels has done more than almost anyone to illuminate the texture of early Christianity, its complex levels of dissent, its idioms of understanding. Her work on early Gnosticism in particular has revealed a church not monolithic in its origins, but rich with competing interpretations of biblical narrative and moral life. I speak, therefore, not only out of a sense of duty to her work, but because ties of friendship exist. Not that I've ever met Professor Pagels before, but there is a larger tie of friendship here, the tie with the Stanford community, having grown up under its lintels and having received her undergraduate degree here. And in her work and in her life, Professor Pagels has exhibited such virtue that everyone should wish to call it to mind, a virtue not simply exhibited on the pages of her book, but in the living of her life. As she herself has put it, summarizing her intellectual growth in a recent interview, and I quote, "When I was in my 20s, there was no religion in my life. Yet I knew that it was a remarkable phenomenon to explore. There are many ways to explore it. You can do it artistically, anthropologically, historically, literarily, musically, archaeologically. There's a great deal of cultural history to explore. And there's a lot about human psychology to explore, too. What people do when they're young is ask, what is this about? Is it a significant part of human life? Is it not? Is it for me, or is it not? That is a question worth asking," end quote. Professor Pagels has long been asking such worthwhile questions. And her answers, to go back to the language of the classical rhetoricians, quote, "transcend the eloquence of all eulogists. I myself fear, as the classical rhetorician would say, my, quote, inability to match her deeds with my words." For it is true, as the Rhetorica ad Herennium notes, that, quote, "we learn from one's praise of others what one's own character is. But one cannot praise without seeking association with the praised." So another strategy for introduction is to link the subject with the speaker. What do they have in common? What could I possibly have in common with Elaine Pagels? True, I taught at Princeton with her in the 1980s, but we never met. True, I'm also from New York, but so are millions. True, I teach at Stanford, but I doubt that her experiences as a student form a bond with me as a teacher. Now, in preparing this introduction, I therefore struggled with self-doubt and with an overwhelming feeling of inadequacy. At moments such as these, I turn not to the volumes of the past, but to the screens of the present. I did what I often do in such situations. I Googled myself. There's nothing like typing in my own name to give me a fleeting sense of self-importance. 881 websites came up. Of course, over 31,000 come up when you Google Elaine Pagels. So I went to Amazon.com to see the figures for my most recently published book. And as I scrolled down to chart its pathetic ranking, at last count, it was 846,000. I came across the following line. "Readers who have purchased this book also purchased books by Elaine Pagels." So my first thought was, have I recently purchased a book by Elaine Pagels? You see, I'm buying copies of my own book on Amazon to make it look like it's actually selling. But I went back and no, I could find no record of that. So perhaps it was an eager student or a colleague or maybe someone in this audience tonight who found something in my work that reminded him or her of Professor Pagels. But then I clicked on the link to her book and went to the site for Professor Pagels' most recent book, Beyond Belief. Now, her book is selling so well that it seemed to me statistically that since everyone is buying Professor Pagels' books, the odds are that someone would buy both her book and my book. And therein lies my dilemma. What is there about Elaine Pagels' work that makes it so important, so well known, and so best-selling? Well, I think there are three things. First, her work achieves an original synthesis in its field. Building on discoveries reaching back to those of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts, her researchers articulate a vision of an early Christian culture that attends to its mysticism, its links to Jewish thought, and its remarkable diversity. Second, her work grows out of a profound personal sensibility. The triumphs and the trials of life are always present in her work, establishing a productive tension between objective scholarship and autobiographical reflection. And third, her work has implications far beyond its historical subject. The study of early Christianity has led Professor Pagels to reflect on faith in today's culture, on the relationships of politics and piety in everyday life. As she put it in the same interview from which I quoted earlier, there is a belief current in America, quote, that Christianity has never changed. And she goes on, the kind of Christianity that pervades the religious right in this country divides the world between the saved and the damned, between God's people and Satan's people, between good and evil. Her researches have shown historically, culturally, and politically the fiction of this sensibility. But they've also shown, at least for me personally, the intricate relationships among early Christianity and Judaism, and in turn, the ways in which religious idiom informs personal identity. Now, according to the Rhetorica ad Herennium, quote, if the introduction has been developed in accordance with the proper methods, there will be no need for a statement of facts to follow it. Well, one fact that Professor Pagels has asked me to call attention to is that she comes to us with a broken ankle. And in spite of her injury, she will be delivering her lecture to us today. But I think more broadly speaking, Professor Pagels' own lecture tonight will provide us with a statement of facts, not a mere recitation of names and dates, but a corrective to our fictions, and a testimony to her stature as America's leading historian of religion. Professor Pagels.
Introduction. I'm very happy to be here. It just feels like coming home to be back here at Stanford. It is coming home in many ways. And I'm also glad that we can have some discussion after this, because I'd love for this to lead into discussion. That's why I wanted you to have a copy of the Gospel of Thomas with you, and I'm sure that many of you have one. So let me just say that I want to share with you the fascination of this archaeological discovery, which is really transforming what we understand about the beginning of Western culture. I admit that when I went to graduate school to study the origins of Christianity, I was actually looking for a kind of golden age. I was looking for what I imagined it would be like when Jesus and his disciples were walking around the hills of Galilee. My professor used to call this play Bible land. What I found was amazing. It was, in fact, quite the opposite. Not only did I discover that there was no Christianity at all at that time, since of course Jesus wasn't a Christian, but I was amazed to find out that my professors of New Testament had file cabinets full of Gospels of which I'd never heard. And you know, many of you know, that this discovery occurred in 1945 and involved many Gospels, including the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of Philip, and dozens of other writings from the beginning of the Christian era, which demonstrated to us a far more complicated and far more exciting world than any of us had ever expected to find back there in the first century when we were looking for sort of the simple early Christian church. And while I was working with my colleagues, other professors, with professors and with other graduate students, we were trying to translate and edit this remarkable find of over 50 ancient Christian writings. And I wrote the Gnostic Gospels at that time, just wanting to say, what difference did it make that we found all this? And what I want to share with you right now is that it's taken quite a while for some of us, me, for example, to get a clear perspective about these sources and what they are. So in just the few minutes we have today, I'd like to look again at one of these texts, the Gospel of Thomas, and just sketch out what it means for the way we understand Christianity today. Now, many of you know that these texts were discovered, although originally written in Greek, they were found in Coptic, which is, although Greek is the language of all the New Testament Gospels, and the Gospel of Thomas was written in Greek, we know because we have fragments from Egypt of papyrus texts with fragments of the Gospel of Thomas in Greek. But we found it in Coptic, a language that was spoken in Egypt about 1600 years ago. And these texts were treasured as holy books in one of the oldest monasteries in Egypt. But these particular texts apparently upset the Bishop of Alexandria, whose name was Athanasius. And he decided they were heretical, and in the spring of the year 367, he wrote an Easter letter to the Christians all over Egypt, telling them to get rid of what he called those secret, illegitimate books that you like so much. And he told them to keep 27 books. He said, these are the springs of salvation, keep these. And it happens that that list of what he told the monks to keep is the first list we have of what we call the New Testament collection. And some, one of the monks, as you know, or maybe several, defied his order and took over 50 of the other books, sealed them in a heavy jar, and buried them under a cliff where the monks used to meditate, where they were found 16 centuries later. Now, we know, of course, that many of these texts have been circulating for 200 years at least, and probably more, I would say 300 years, before Athanasius declared them banned. About 160 years after the death of Jesus, another Christian bishop named Irenaeus was distressed that many Christians in his congregation in rural Gaul, in present-day France, treasured what he also called illegitimate secret writings. And he wrote a massive attack on the people who did. I enjoy reading Irenaeus, as you may know. He said, the heretics say they have more gospels than there really are. But really, they have no gospel that is not full of blasphemy. Now, he goes on to say that actually, of all the dozens of writings that various Christians revered as holy books, there were really only four that were genuine gospels. And you guessed it. These are the ones that are in the New Testament collection, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. All the rest, he said, were illegitimate. But anyway, he said, there can only be four Gospels. There cannot be more, there cannot be fewer. Why not? Well, he said, there are four corners of the universe, and there are four principal winds and four pillars that hold up the sky, and so you can see that there can only be four Gospels. So it's a kind of scientific approach. And if you ask why these four, Irenaeus says, well, these were actually written by the disciples of Jesus or the disciples of the disciples. Now, there aren't many scholars today who would agree with that. They're all attributed to disciples of Jesus or to their disciples. But so are the ones that were found in 1947, in Nag Hammadi, 1945, 1947, in Nag Hammadi. So So we really can't verify who actually wrote these texts. All of them are attributed to these disciples. So when an international group of scholars first read and published the Gospel of Thomas, it was published first in 1959. The primary question they were asking is this: what does the Gospel of Thomas tell us about Gnosticism, by which they meant heresy? And the scholars knew what they were getting. They knew what they were dealing with, because the fathers of the church had already told us that these gospels, this kind of gospel, was heresy. The word means choice. This is something that certain leaders of the church thought wasn't good for most people. And therefore, they assumed that the Gospel of Thomas must not only be false, but that it was written later than the real gospels. And since most scholars agree that the Gospel of Mark was written about 40 years after the death of Jesus, and Matthew and Luke, which both use the Gospel of Mark and add to it, were written maybe 10 years or 20 after that, and the Gospel of John another decade later, these international group of scholars concluded that the secret Gospel of Thomas must be very, very late, because it's obviously heresy, say 100 years after the death of Jesus. Second, since they assumed that it was heresy and they knew it was Gnosticism, they knew what they would find there, because Irenaeus had already told us in his ancient Writings Against the Heretics, his famous five volumes called The Refutation and Overthrow of Falsely So-Called Gnosis. Basically, it defines heresy. Irenaeus had said, this is what you'll find. You'll find dualism, very negative views of the world and creation. You'll find philosophical speculations, nihilism, bizarre mythology, weird things. And so when the first editors of the Gospel of Thomas, which you have in your hand, found basically no evidence for dualism, nihilism, philosophy, or weird mythology, many assumed that this shows how sneaky heretics are. Scholars assumed that if it's not there explicitly, it must be there implicitly, and I can give you hundreds of monographs and articles that find it by referring to other texts and showing that what it really means is something else. Before I got to graduate school, though, there was a beginning of a second stage of research, and our professors were doing it. Many were beginning to say, wait a minute, if you just look at this text, it says, these are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which the twin, Judas Thomas, wrote down. What is it? It's just a list of the sayings of Jesus. Now, when you start to do what they started then to do, you compare that list with what you find in Matthew and Luke. They said, wait, this actually corresponds to the writings we find in Matthew and Luke. For example, Jesus says in Matthew, blessed are the poor in spirit. In Luke, he says, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Matthew turned it into a metaphor, and most authors think that Luke is earlier. The Gospel of Thomas has Jesus say, blessed are you poor, for yours. Second person plural address. I mean, if they were the words of Jesus, this probably would be closer to the way he spoke them. So many scholars began to say, wait a minute, maybe this isn't just very late derivative tradition. Maybe this is early Jesus material. And they began to carefully examine these, and the question in the second stage of research, which I'd like to say, was what can the Gospel of Thomas tell us about Jesus? And some scholars, including my professor Helmut Kester, who edited the text you have here, said, wait, this is not a late text. This is maybe the earliest one we have. This he dated it to 20 years after the death of Jesus. That would make it earlier than any of the others. I think that dating is a little wish fulfillment. But people wanting to get back to, you know, what did Jesus really say? But this approach started a kind of cottage industry among New Testament scholars, some based in the Jesus Seminar in Santa Rosa. Many people suggesting that actually this contains our earliest guide to the teachings of Jesus. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. I think it certainly seems to have some early Jesus sayings in it. I think there's no doubt about that. But it also has a lot of later additions and interpretations of sayings of Jesus, as does Matthew, as does Luke, and as does the Gospel of John. So I would like to say I've started on a third kind of research, saying it's not so easy to sort out which sayings go back to Jesus and which don't. So the question in my research at this point wasn't, what can it tell us about Jesus? Because that's very hard to figure out. But what can it tell us about the early Christian movement? What can it tell us about followers of Jesus who were contending with one another about Jesus and the meaning of his message at the end of the first century? What I came to see was this, that when you start to compare the Gospel of Thomas with the Gospel of John or the Gospel of Matthew and Luke, you can learn a great deal about the construction of Christian tradition in that early period, particularly when I started to compare John, the Gospel of John in the New Testament, and the Gospel of Thomas. I became aware that what we're seeing when you start to read them together is an intense, contentious, I guess you could call it conversation, but really it's more like an argument, between different groups of the followers of Jesus. And what they're arguing about is the question, who is Jesus and what is the good news? I mean, which is of course what gospel means. What is the good news about him? Now, this was surprising to me to find that these two texts were challenging each other, because I came to conclude that the author of the Gospel of John knew the kind of teaching we find in this text here in Thomas and thoroughly detested it. And that he wrote his own gospel to show that this kind of teaching is dead wrong. And he wrote his gospel to set people straight. But this conclusion is very far from where I started. When I started to compare the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Thomas, it was conventional wisdom from several colleagues and worth considering that these two gospels have a great deal in common. In the first place, if you read the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Thomas, you see that both of the authors assume that you already know a lot about Jesus. They already assume that the reader, the hearer, knows the kind of story that Mark tells, that Jesus went around Galilee, that he was baptized by John the Baptist, that he preached, that he healed, that he taught, that he was crucified, and that his followers said he came back from the dead. They both assume that you know this, and both of them are not out to repeat that story. They're out to supplement it with a kind of advanced level teaching for people that they thought were ready. So that's why the Gospel of Thomas begins with the words, these are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote down. The other Gospels contain public teaching, what Jesus taught out there, presumably on the hills and in the plains and in crowds of 5,000 people. This is intimate teaching that's given to certain people, certain disciples, entrusted to them alone and meant to be kept secret. The Gospel of John also claims to give you intimate secret teaching. If you look, for example, there's a whole section of the Gospel of John that's only there, it's not in any of the others, from chapter 13 to 18. The night before Jesus was crucified, John says, he talked to his disciples intimately and gave them what people call the farewell discourses, in which he told them things that were meant to be known to the initiates and to the intimates alone. So there's a lot in common there in terms of genre. And second, they both contain a lot of teaching they attribute to Jesus, which is very similar. The language is similar. The diction is similar. Many scholars assume that they have common traditions, common sayings, and that's probably the case. They both interpret the teaching of Jesus in very similar ways. For example, the Gospel of Mark says that Jesus' preaching, his gospel, was this. In the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus said, the kingdom of God is coming. Repent and believe in the gospel. And the whole of the Gospel of Mark has a huge urgency, because Mark suggests that God's kingdom is imminent. The world is about to be transformed. Within the lifetime of his disciples, he says in chapter 9, chapter 13 suggests that the world is about to undergo catastrophic transformation, war, catastrophe, trauma, and then the end of time. But the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Thomas, both written about two generations later, reinterpret this teaching in very similar ways. For example, John says, well, Jesus meant that the judgment of the world not only is coming in the future, but it's right here now. He meant not only that at the end the dead will be resurrected, but that can happen now. That the kingdom of God, which comes at the end of time, is a present reality. It's something that you can experience here and now. And the Gospel of Thomas, as you can see, if you look at, for example, saying 3, Jesus ridicules the idea that the kingdom is a kind of place, or is up there, or is some kind of literal event. Jesus said, if those who leave you say to you, look, the kingdom is in the sky, then the birds of the sky will get there first. If they say to you, it is in the sea, then the fish will get there first. Rather, the kingdom is inside of you, and it is outside of you. When you come to know yourselves, then you will know that it is you who are the children of the living Father. Well, this gospel, like John, suggests that the kingdom of God is a kind of spiritual reality which transforms the person who receives it. In the third place, when people ask, well, how do you find this kingdom of God then? When is it going to happen? How do you get there? The Gospel of John and the Gospel of Thomas both say the same thing. The Gospel of John and the Gospel of Thomas say, you don't look at the end of time. You look back at the beginning. You have to go back to the beginning. According to saying 3, or here in the Gospel of Thomas, when the disciples say in saying 18, for example, the disciples, they tell us what the end will be like. I'm translating a little bit. I'm sorry, the Coptic is susceptible to translation. Tell us what the end will be like. And Jesus said, have you discovered then the beginning, that you looked for the end? Where the beginning is where the end will be. Blessed is the one who stands in the beginning. What does that mean? And then Jesus says something even stranger. He says, blessed is the one who came into being before he came into being. And it's hard to understand. What does that mean? How do you come into being before you come into being? What was there in the beginning before we came into being? Or even before the universe came into being? Well, the author of the Gospel of Thomas is thinking that you know, of course, the book of Genesis, and is referring to the book of Genesis, and knows that you would know the saying in Genesis that says, in the beginning God said, let there be light, and there was light. And of course, first century rabbis agreed, as many would today, that the light that came into being before the universe was not ordinary light. Instead, it was a kind of divine energy. It was a metaphor for the divine energy that brought all things into being. So, according to the Gospel of Thomas, when the disciples say, well, who is Jesus anyway? The answer is, he is one who comes as a kind of manifestation of the divine light. So, take a look at saying 77, for example. A remarkable saying, I think. Jesus says, I am the light that is before all things. I am all things. From me everything came forth. Everything comes back to me. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up a rock, and you will find me there. So it's as though Jesus is speaking as if he were the divine light in person. And the divine light that pervades not only human beings, but everything in the universe, even rocks, even logs and stones. What Thomas is probably doing is he probably has in mind a tradition that the prophet Ezekiel knew, which is a tradition which imagines that that the Lord, when Ezekiel says he saw him on a throne, what did he look like? Well, Ezekiel said, dazzling light of fire and lightning and radiance and emeralds and diamonds. I mean, it was this glory. I mean, what in Hebrew is called kavod, the glory, the radiance of God, his shining, Ezekiel said. That's what they saw on the throne, this shining being. And so in ancient times, many rabbis who read Genesis 1:26, it says, God made Adam in his image, thought, well, what does that mean? In what kind of image did God make the human race? The author of the Gospel of Thomas would have agreed with many others that the image in which human beings were made is the kind of divine energy, the divine light that brought the world into being. It's that divine source in us that pervades everything, ourselves included. So how does one find it? How do we get access to it? According to Thomas, Jesus says, you have to look for it. When you look for it, you will find it not only in Jesus, but in yourself. So according to Thomas, the good news is not just about Jesus. The good news is also about you and me. The good news is not only Jesus comes from the divine light, but you and I come from that light. We are all brought forth from the same source. And although we're ordinarily unaware of this, and ordinarily we identify ourselves in terms of how we differ from one another, we identify ourselves by name or gender, social, ethnic, political affiliation, so forth. But the Gospel of Thomas suggests that when we come to know ourselves spiritually, we'll come to know that we are the children of God. And that is something beyond those differences, something that is a source that is essentially the same. So if you look at saying 50, for example, this is the good news according to the Gospel of Thomas. Jesus says to the disciples, I think people used this when they did baptisms in the Gospel of Thomas. Anyway, they asked these questions. Jesus said to his disciples, if people say to you, where do you come from? I'm going to say Palo Alto. You say, we come from the light, the place where the light came into being in the beginning. And if they say, well, who are you? Say, we are children of the light and children of the living Father. So the good news of this gospel is that the disciple comes to see that he is a child of God just like Jesus. So at the end of the gospel, take a look at saying 108, for example. Jesus says to Thomas, whoever drinks from my mouth will become like me. And I myself will become that person, and the mysteries will be revealed to him. And I think this idea that I will become that person will become like me, is the meaning of attributing this gospel to Thomas. This is an Aramaic name. It's a nickname, actually. The disciple's given name was Judas. They always call him Judas, not Iscariot, the other Judas. But the disciples called him Thomas. That was his nickname because he was a twin. And I suggest that this gospel is attributed to Thomas the twin as a symbolic way of saying, yes, and when you come to know who you are, you come to know that you are also the twin of Jesus on a deep level. And so that helped me understand one of my favorite sayings from this gospel. It's actually saying 70, in which Jesus said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. I used to think this was a psychological statement, and I think it works very well on that level. But now I understand it's also a theological and religious statement. It's a saying about what you have within you, whether you know it or not, is access to the divine source, because you come from it and you belong to it, the divine light, often hidden and obscure. Now, turn to the Gospel of John. You find many similarities. John also, of course, speaks of Jesus as a manifestation of the divine light. In John 8, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Whoever comes to me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So John agrees that Jesus is a manifestation of the divine light. But the bad news, as John puts it, is that you and I are not. So when it comes to the practical question, how do you find that light? John challenges, and I think the author of the Gospel of John hopes to refute the kind of teaching you find in Thomas. That is, I think, as I said right now, to speak briefly, as I said, they're using common sources, but they turn them in different directions. So John wants to say, yes, there's a lot of truth in what they teach, but they get the crucial point wrong. You and I have no access to God apart from Jesus, and this is how he does it. So So he starts with Genesis 1 because he knows that the answer to this is yes, but the divine light came into being in the beginning of the world, and it's, the world comes from the divine light, so why isn't it available? So if you look at the beginning of the Gospel of John, he starts with light in the beginning of the world, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was the light of human beings, and so forth. It's wonderful. John says, yes, I know all of that. But then he goes on to say three things that deny that that light was ever available to anyone at all before Jesus of Nazareth appeared in the world. So he says, no, John 1:5, the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness never grasped it. The darkness did not grasp it. It's translated more correctly, more nicely. It says the darkness has not overcome it in many Bibles. But that's not what the Greek says. The Greek says the darkness never grasped that divine light. So nobody ever apprehended it. The second thing John says in the 10th verse of the beginning of his introduction is that the light came into the world, but the world didn't recognize it. It didn't know it. It didn't perceive it. And third, he says it came to its own people, but its own people rejected it. So John wants to say, yes, I know there was always divine light available, but it was never available, ever, at all, until, verse 14, he says, when Jesus came into the world, he says, the divine light became flesh and dwelt among us, became an actual human being in the form of Jesus of Nazareth, and only then, says John, we saw his shining. We saw his glory. We saw the glory of God. We saw it in Jesus of Nazareth, and John will always say, and guess who he was? He was the only begotten Son of God. He will always use this word, only Son, God's only begotten. It means utterly unique, single one, nobody like him, certainly not you and me. And this is John's favorite description of Jesus. He says, for example, the world and all the people in it are lost in sin and evil, sunken into desperate straits. And it says Jesus came into the world not so much to enlighten other people, but to save them from sin and damnation. Remember the famous words from John 3:16, 18, I've seen them in football stadiums. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Notice that only begotten Son is the only way. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe in him is already condemned because he doesn't believe in the name of the only begotten Son of God. So what are you supposed to believe? I mean, what does it mean to believe in him? What believe what? Now, you notice that in John's Gospel, Jesus doesn't give the Sermon on the Mount. He doesn't give the story of the prodigal son. He doesn't give so much other teaching that you find in Matthew and Luke. It's not there. What does Jesus teach in John? He teaches what scholars call the I am saying. And if you start to look at John again, you'll see what he says is, I am. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the vine. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the water of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine. On and on. In other words, whatever you need, I am that. But John also knows that you should understand when in chapter 8, when Jesus is speaking to Jews who don't believe in him, Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. And of course, you're supposed to get it, that these are the words, this is the name that the Lord gave to Moses when he said, tell them I am has sent you. And so Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. So Jesus really is God in person, right? And that is what the Gospel of John teaches. At that point, John says Jesus' listeners, being devout Jews, picked up stones to stone him for blasphemy, for making himself equal with God. But for John, that's the point. Jesus is God in human form. At the end of the Gospel, Thomas suddenly gets it and addresses him as my Lord and my God. So according to John, the good news of the Gospel is that Jesus is God incarnate. And the bad news, as I said, is that the rest of us are nothing like Jesus. So you remember how the Gospel of Thomas has Jesus say, if people say to you, who are you, say, we come from the light. Look at chapter 8 of the Gospel of John. It says the opposite. Jesus speaks about difference, not affinity, with the rest of human race. He says, I am from above, you are from below. I am not from this world, but you are from this world. So what are the disciples to do? All they can do is believe. And what they have to believe is that Jesus is the only begotten Son. John says he wrote the whole gospel so that you will believe this and be saved. Now, because John associates Thomas with mistaken teaching, his gospel, and this just amazes me, turned Thomas, who in the other gospels appears only as a name on a list of Jesus' disciples, into a character. He actually is a caricature of the disciple to this day. We call him Doubting Thomas, right? And it's only in the Gospel of John that you find this character. Because John, I think, wants to caricature the teaching associated with this disciple who is completely off track. So John apparently knows that Thomas was the spiritual mentor of certain Christians who followed this kind of other teaching. So he tries to discredit him by turning him into an ignorant, unauthorized, faithless disciple. And he sketches three episodes that do this quite well. In chapter 11, for example, Jesus' friend Lazarus has died. And Jesus tells his disciples, I'm going to go to wake Lazarus up. And they say, don't you know that he's dead? And Jesus suggests that he's going to raise him. And Thomas, of course, doesn't believe it. But he says, let's go with him. We'll die with him. John 11. Second episode, John 14. Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and he says the famous words, I'm going away. I'm going to my Father. But you know the way. You know where I'm going, and you know the way. Thomas doesn't know anything. So he says, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? And so John has Jesus turn to Thomas and make the point that he wants to make to all Christians who follow that kind of teaching associated with the disciple Thomas. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Got that? So this is apparently directed against the teaching of these so-called Thomas Christians. So finally, the coup de grace. And this is the end of it. John writes the famous scene in which Jesus actually comes back from the dead to chastise Thomas. But notice that what happens in John's version is very different. It's not what happens in Luke's. It's not what happens in Matthew. Read the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew, and you'll see this is what they tell you. They tell you that after the death of Jesus, he appeared to his disciples. To whom? To the 11, they say. Well, that means the disciples, but not Judas Iscariot, because he had betrayed Jesus and he had departed and perhaps committed suicide by then. But Matthew and Luke say, to the 11, and they name the 11. Thomas, of course, is among them. Now look at the Gospel of John. John says, after Jesus' death, because the point of the story, by the way, for Matthew and Luke is, to whom is Jesus' authority delegated? Who represents Jesus now that he's dead? That's the question. So John tells the story like this. He says, yes, after Jesus' death, he appeared to his disciples. And he did three things in chapter 21. He first said, you are my apostles, which means you are my representatives. Second, he breathed on them the Holy Spirit. That is, he gave them his power. And third, he said, you know, if you remit people's sins, they're remitted. If you don't, then they're not. In other words, he gave them his authority. Now look at the next line. Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So John says there were only 10 at the meeting, and Thomas missed it. So what John is trying to show very clearly in the narrative is that Jesus never made Thomas an apostle like the others. Jesus never gave him power that he gave to the other 10. And furthermore, when they told him, where were you? They told him what had happened. He refused to believe it. So he said, I'm not going to believe it unless I can have the, you know, I can put my hand in his side and I can touch him. And, That is, he insists on coming to know for himself. That it's a caricature, I think, of somebody who doesn't take somebody else's word for it, which is what John thinks he ought to do, but rather somebody who wants to come to know from experience what is true, which is, in fact, the modus operandi of the Gospel of Thomas. Anyway, here, the way John tells the story, Jesus comes back from the dead and gives Thomas the proof he insists on, tells him, stop being faithless, believe. And then this, as far as, that is, Thomas's refusal to believe is simply a stubborn refusal. And so finally, Jesus adds the words, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe, unlike, of course, Thomas. So I think John wrote the scene with some satisfaction to show that Thomas finally got it and finally admitted that he was wrong, and John was right. So Thomas, seeing Jesus, is overwhelmed, and he stammers out the words, I understand who you are now. You're not my brother. You're not my twin. My Lord and my God, he says. Okay. So this is the climax of the story for the Gospel of John. This is when Thomas sees the error of his ways, falls on his knees, and capitulates to John's view of Jesus. So we can see that, this is the conclusion, that John and Thomas seem to take the same body of teaching, or a common body of teaching, in different directions. One declares that faith in Jesus offers forgiveness of sin and salvation, only Jesus. The other urges spiritual seeking to discover the divine light that shines from within, as well as from Jesus, and as well as from the universe. So no wonder it's about 200 to 300 years later when Christian leaders decided to include John in the New Testament and not only exclude Gospels like the Gospel of Thomas, but call them heresy. This decision would enormously influence Christianity as we know it and as we've received it ever since. So from the 2nd to the 4th century, actually I began to realize that it's John's language that certain Christian leaders, and Athanasius, our friend the bishop, was chief among them, used John's language to praise Jesus' divinity. And other people, Irenaeus, said, yes, the other Gospels didn't quite reveal his divinity. They speak as if he were a human. But only John understands that he is divine. And Irenaeus chose those four Gospels and taught all subsequent generations of Christians really to read the Gospels of Matthew and Mark and Luke through the lens of the Gospel of John. So that most people today, if they're brought up Christian, will assume that Christians believe that Jesus is somehow God in person. Certainly, it's been, for many people, what it's meant to be Christian, or at least an Orthodox Christian, which is, of course, straight thinking, is what it means. Literally. The Nicene Creed that's developed by the Catholic Church in the 4th century and adopted by many Protestants uses John's language, says, Jesus is God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not created like us were created. He is ontologically God, one with the Father, essentially the same as God himself. But how the New Testament and the creeds developed is quite another story. And this is enough for now, so I'd like to open up our discussion. Thank you.